For the last 2 weeks, we have presented to you the prosecution's case against Sandy Melgar. You've now heard firsthand Sandy's first police interrogation, which is what led the police to suspecting her to begin with, and then you heard from prosecutor Colleen Barnett, who made her case for guilt to you. At this point, this season has been somewhat one-sided. We've done something that we typically haven't done before, in presenting the guilty side of this argument first. And now it's time to see if the investigation holds up under scrutiny. And this is also a little bit out of order for us. Typically, before we get to this point, we cover the crime scene and develop a profile, and even take a deep dive into all of the police documents. But with this case, things are a little bit different. This investigation is the closest thing that we've ever done to real-time crowdsourcing. You're getting information at the same time I get it. So far, we've already obtained a lot of crime scene photos and a lot of documents. There's also still a lot that we don't have. By the time you hear this episode, hopefully, Mike and I will have been to the district attorney's office in Houston to get copies of the rest of the police and the prosecutor's file. We're tying all this in with our trip down to Texas for Edward 8's release, and then we'll really begin breaking down this crime scene and this crime and the investigation, trial, and conviction. But since we don't have all of those documents and photos yet, we're going to take a little bit of a different route this week. What I'm sure you noticed while listening to Colleen Barnett break down the case against Sandy, there isn't much direct evidence. The entire case is both circumstantial and even speculative. As Sandy's attorney Max Seacrest said at trial, this case is heavy on theory and short on evidence. So since the bulk of the state's case revolves around a theory of motive and assumptions about Sandy and Jim's relationship, we're now going to give you the other side of that story. In today's episode, you're going to hear an interview with a very close family friend of the Melgars, Stephanie Davies. Stephanie grew up in the same Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Hall as Sandy, Jim, and their daughter Liz. She knows the family intimately, and she has a fresh perspective on what part the witnesses played in the Melgars' lives. After a quick break for our only ad, we're going to present to you the other side of the story as told by Stephanie. Today's episode is sponsored by Stamps.com. These days, you can get practically everything on demand, just like our podcast. You listen whenever you want to, when it's convenient for you. So why are you still taking trips to the post office to mail letters and packages when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? If you haven't tried Stamps.com yet, you need to give them a shot because it really is a game changer. At the beginning of every month, Mike and I ship out all of our t-shirts and hats to our Patreon subscribers, and that process could eat up an entire day. But because of Stamps.com, we're able to go through the entire process in a fraction of the time, and we never have to leave the office. We do it all right here from our computer and printer. We set the box outside for the mail carrier to pick it up, and we're done, and we're back in business. No trips across town, no waiting in line, and we don't even have to do our work when the post office is open. With Stamps.com, you can access all of the amazing services of the post office right from your desk 24/7 when it's convenient for you. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, using your own computer and printer. Then the mail carrier picks it up and that's it. Just click, print, mail, and you're done. It couldn't be easier. Stamps.com is a product that we use here in the NBI studios almost every single day. And I don't know how we would even operate without it anymore. And right now, use TRUTH for this special offer, which includes up to $55 in free postage, a digital scale, and a 4-week trial. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage and type in TRUTH. That's Stamps.com. Enter TRUTH. Okay, Stephanie, first of all, can we start off with you explaining your relationship with the Melgars?
I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness as well. So our families went to the same congregation. And Liz, the their daughter was, I want to say, I don't even know how much younger she is than me, maybe 10 years, but she was closer to my sister in age. So she would come over all the our house all the time. And actually, when Sandy was first diagnosed with lupus, I think that she ended up going to Greece or something for some special treatment. And we babysat Liz while they were gone for, however long that they were gone. So, our parents were good friends, and we were at their house all the time when I was growing up, and,
And that relationship continued on into adulthood, right? Or at least after this incident, you guys kind of reconnected?
Yeah. When we reconnected, actually, on Reddit, because there are, groups for ex-Jehovah's Witnesses. And so it's the kind of thing that most people aren't really able to understand unless they've been through it. And, you look for support in that. And we recognized each other on the group and, started, talking and messaging again. But I'd always kind of had some sort of contact with Sandy, more so than Liz, actually, over the years, because there was a lady that was one of Sandy's best friends, and she had also kind of been almost like a second mother to me growing up. My household was sort of chaotic, and they kind of acted as like a refuge for me and tried to sort of intervene. And so I would see Sandy a lot throughout the years whenever I would go and, spend time with that friend.
Okay. So I guess that's a good place to start for us is, so you knew Sandy very well. How would you describe Sandy? What is your impression of Sandy just in general as a human being?
I mean, when I was a kid, I remember thinking of them as, she and Jim both, as just very vanilla. I was like a young teenager. I just thought they were boring, honestly.
Right.
They were just like normal, nice people. They were always friendly and always, she was never rude to me or anything. And I remember them laughing a lot.
Sandy and Jim?
Yeah. Just whenever we were over there and, the families were spending time together, I pictured them, especially Sandy, just laughing and having fun. And then when I got older, I wasn't shunned, I was publicly reproved, is what it's called. Facebook came out, my own brother didn't have me on his Facebook, but Sandy reached out to me and she added me as a member of her family. And that's like beyond touching when your own family doesn't really have that much to do with you, And so, that meant a lot to me. Like she would just do things like that, she was a kind person. She is a kind person.
So let's talk about, you said you were, I forgot the term you just used, but you've left the Jehovah's Witnesses. Let's talk about that. And going into this, knowing that, this obviously is a bit of a touchy subject. I don't like to talk ill of anyone's faith regardless of what it is, mm-hmm. but in this instant, you have an inside knowledge of not only the Jehovah's Witnesses that the Melgars were involved with, but also how they interacted with them and how they handled mm-hmm. some of the rules and things like that. So when you left what was that term you used again?
Publicly reproved. It means that my privileges were removed. They make an announcement during one of the meetings that, this person has been publicly approved and is basically no longer considered like fit association kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that whole thing was kind of weird. Yeah, I was 14 years old and I still had to go to all the meetings, but people will speak to you. I was never baptized. So that's why I didn't have to be disfellowshipped.
Mm-hmm.
But people will speak to you if you're not disfellowshipped. They can't really hang out with you because you're bad association. So when I went and they made the announcement that night, it was almost like, everyone was coming up and comforting my mother, in tears and stuff as if I had died. And I was sitting right there just kind of like, oh my God, this is so weird.
And if you're not comfortable sharing this, you don't have to, but I'm curious, what does a 14-year-old do that causes that to happen?
I was pretty, there's a lot of rules growing up as a witness. you know, you're not really allowed to associate with other kids at school. You can't really participate in extracurricular activities. You can't go to school dances. You can't do any of the holiday stuff. You're really sort of isolated. And so your only friends are the people in the congregation, you know? And doing normal kid things is, you get in trouble, you know? Like, I remember I had to run away from home to go to the eighth grade dance, you know?
Right.
But I was very stubborn and strong-willed and sort of, you know, independently minded. And I rebelled fairly early. And so by the time I was 14, I was pretty much doing what I wanted to do. I had just, whatever I did, I decided that the consequences were worth it. You know, so I didn't even really try to hide anything. I just had to try to get away with it. And so I had a boyfriend at school. And, you know, we thought that we were in love and we were going to be together forever. Right. And so we lost our virginity to each other. And, you know, I didn't really try to hide it. I asked my parents if I could please be put on birth control. And they said no, because they didn't want to condone it. And then they went to the elders to tell them that I had had sex. And so I had to have an elders meeting with three men where, you know, they talked to me about the fact that I had had sex and if I was intending to continue having sex. And, you know, you have to talk about exactly what you did. And I mean, it's pretty awkward, you know, for a 14-year-old girl talking to three grown men about your sex life, you know?
Right.
And since I wasn't exactly sorry or, you know, promising that I wasn't going to keep doing it, then, you know, they had to do what they had to do.
Okay. And that was, from the way you're describing it, was a very big deal in the church. Like I said, people were consoling your mother because this happened to her daughter.
Yeah.
I want to be respectful and use the proper terminology. And I was told that you don't call it a church. So to speak.
Kingdom Hall.
Right. So was this all the same Kingdom Hall that the Melgars went to?
Yeah.
Okay. And so they were there for that. And then, so how did your family react to that?
I mean, my family, I mean, to this day, they moved away. They moved out of state when I was 17, and I stayed here. And so we haven't even, you know, lived in the same state for that long. And they've really kind of not been a part of my life more than they have been. You know, we talk every so often, but it's not, you know, we don't spend a lot of time together. I mean, I have two kids that, you know, are 16 and 18, and I think they've met my brother maybe twice, three times.
Okay.
Met my mom, you know, maybe five, six times ever. So it's just, they've just kind of not really, I started trying to live with friends basically as soon as that happened. Mm-hmm. And I think it was easier for them to let me, you know, so that they didn't really have to deal with it. So I haven't really lived at home that much since then.
Okay. Now, if we can talk a little bit about the rules, because as you know, the prosecutor in this case used the Jehovah's Witness faith as motive, saying that Sandy would have killed Jim because she couldn't get divorced, because if she got divorced, right, she would be excommunicated. And so there's a lot of layers there to kind of unpack. One, you know, one being, did she have friends who were not witnesses, and would she be able to do that? And what are their feelings on divorce, and how would all of that play out? I mean, how do you feel about the whole idea of that being the motive?
I don't know if Sandy would have friends outside of the religion. I mean, some people do, some people don't. It's not really obviously encouraged. You know, they obviously frown upon divorce, but except in cases of cheating, that's a valid reason for divorce where they're, you know, they wouldn't really give you issue. They might encourage you still to work it out, but you wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be so frowned upon. In other scenarios, as far as I know, you can get divorced and maybe they'll privately or publicly reprove you or something. in some scenarios, maybe if you were the one who cheated and wanted the divorce, maybe then there would be an issue. But from what I remember, a lot of times the only time that you would really be disfellowshipped for that is if you got divorced and then you tried to marry someone else. You know, Liz was disfellowshipped, and she still had a very close relationship with her family. So to me, in terms of that being, you know, her fear of being disfellowshipped, making murder worth, you know, that is sort of ridiculous, because she still would have had her family, her daughter, her grandkids, you know, and that's if she got disfellowshipped. And when you do get disfellowshipped, you can always be reinstated. It typically takes about a year. Okay. You know, you have to still keep going to all of the meetings, you know, basically show them that you're sorry and you want to be a witness. And then, you know, they make an announcement that you're reinstated and everything goes back to normal. So it wouldn't even be a permanent thing.
So let's talk about the disfellowship for a minute. So first of all, so if I understood you right, typically with just a divorce, you wouldn't be disfellowshipped for that.
Yeah, not necessarily.
Okay.
I mean, I think it would depend on the circumstances, but it's not just a given.
Okay. And then what does it mean to be disfellowshipped? Like you said, Liz was disfellowshipped. Mm-hmm. And my understanding of that has always been that means the other witnesses won't communicate with them at all. But obviously, she did still communicate with her family. Sandy and Jim were both witnesses, and they still had a close relationship with Liz even after she was disfellowshipped. So what is it mm-hmm. supposed to mean to be disfellowshipped?
Typically, if it's not a family member, then you wouldn't talk to the person. They look at it almost like a time out, you know, they're trying to teach you something. They're trying to make you feel the loss of your community so that hopefully you'll pull it together and come back. You know, they think that they're doing it out of love. If you go up to someone and you say hi to them, and they are supposed to immediately tell you that they're disfellowshipped, and then, you know, you would just kind of, okay, sorry, and, you know, go your own way.
So in last week's interview, we heard the prosecutor, Colleen Barnett, explaining her thoughts about the Jehovah's Witnesses and some of their rules. And, you know, as awkward as it was to talk about, she brought it up as part of the case of guilt against Sandy, that there were sex toys on the bed. And she said that sex toys are against the rules for Jehovah's Witnesses. Does that, as a former witness, does that resonate with you? Is that correct?
I mean, I don't really remember hearing that, honestly. You know, as far as I remember, when you're married, there's not that much direction given as far as your sex life.
Right, and that's the case with most, at least that I'm familiar with, Christian religions, different denominations or faiths, that, you know, what happens between a man and a wife in their bedroom is kind of between them.
Right. And there are a lot of things in the Jehovah's Witness religion that they consider to be conscience matters. Like, they'll sort of, you know, offer you things to think about. You know, so that's where the difference in personality comes in, because some people hear that, oh, that's a conscience matter. And for them, you know, the more rule-following types, you know, they're going to take it to the extreme of, you know, okay, well, you know, my conscience won't let me do that. But then you have others that are like, okay, well, I don't really feel like that's a big deal. So, you know, I don't feel the need to stop that or not do that.
Right. And one of the things that I wonder if it falls into that category, you know, the prosecution made the point about, you know, she can't get divorced. And it's funny what you said, based on my, I used to study the Christian theology quite a bit years ago, that the divorce is not necessarily the sin. It's the remarriage. So,
right.
So that didn't make sense, because, you know, in God's eyes, according to them, oh, you're still married to that other person, but you can't.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So at that point, it's almost like you're committing adultery.
Right, because, you know, it was, you know, the basis is the biblical verses saying that, you know, what God has joined together, no man can tear apart. So they're basically not acknowledging the divorce. So I thought that was strange that she would be disfellowshipped for getting divorced. But one thing that I was wondering about was, while she's making this argument about a potential divorce as a motive, they both, Sandy and Jim, who was an elder, were drinking alcohol. And I don't know what I have some friends years ago that were Jehovah's Witnesses, and I remember them saying they don't drink at all. And I don't know if that was a matter of conscience or is that a rule with the Witnesses?
No, I think that probably falls on the conscience matter spectrum. That's definitely not a rule. What the rule is it's about, they talk about drunkenness.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not supposed to be going out and doing trash or whatever, but it's, you know, as far as my experiences have been, it's not a big deal to go have a drink. They don't really hang out like in bars and stuff like that. But, you know, if they go out to dinner or something, I've never seen, in my experience, I haven't seen any of them have an issue with having a drink.
Okay, that makes sense. And so as far as the being rule followers, with your experience that you've had with Jim and with Sandy, that you mentioned that, you know, when your family wasn't speaking to you, that Sandy still would keep in touch with you. Did they strike you as being the strict rule followers, as you described it, within the Jehovah's Witnesses, or were they more moderate, or do you know?
I mean, I would say they seemed fairly modern to me. I mean, they were definitely, I mean, like you said, Jim was an elder. I mean, they appeared to be, you know, this was genuinely what they believed, you know? But I do remember that, I know that when Liz was disfellowshipped, essentially, she was raped. And she didn't tell. It came out somehow, some other way. And it was basically insinuated that because she did not scream or anything like that, that it was the same as committing fornication.
When she was raped.
Yeah. And the scripture that was used was one about, I want to say it's in Deuteronomy, like maybe 23, 24, something like that. But it talks about if a woman doesn't scream, then she's, you know, basically committing fornication, something about her being stoned, her and the man, or something like that. And that was the scripture that was used. Well, Jim, as an elder, didn't agree with that judgment, you know? And he fought on Liz's behalf, you know, for that not to be the action taken, for her to not be disfellowshipped for that, refused to kick her out of his house. And it's in the end, I think he stepped down as an elder because he didn't agree with that. So, I mean, I think that they followed the rules in terms of, you know, as their faith allowed them to. But when it came down to a matter involving their own family, you know, they went with what they felt was right.
Right. And that story just kind of gave me chills just to think about it, because it may not seem like a big deal to some, but knowing the seriousness of the Witnesses and when they disfellowship someone, the fact that Jim, even being an elder, fought for his daughter and then stepped down. And then, because was she an adult at that point?
Yes.
Yeah. And so at that point, if I understand correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, when she's been disfellowshipped and she's an adult, they're supposed to completely kick her out of the house.
Yeah, yeah. You're basically supposed to have as little, if it's your family member, you're supposed to have as little communication with them as is necessary.
Okay. And so they didn't do that. So, I mean, it may seem trivial, but to me that speaks volumes toward, again, that idea of motive, as far as faith is important to them, I think, but it sounds to me that doesn't trump family for them. And
yes, they still had their own minds and they went with their conscience.
Right. And they stayed in with the Witnesses after that, right? Jim and Sandy both, but they just weren't going to, that's a rule they weren't going to follow.
Right.
Yeah. Cause I know that Liz said that they, up until Jim's death and then afterward until Sandy went to prison, still spoke with Sandy on the phone nearly every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So moving past the church, you've also have some more firsthand experience. I mean, you've talked a little bit about, you know, the family and how they were together. You've seen Jim and Sandy interact together. From your perspective, and also being very close with Liz, I'm sure, talking about it, what was your impression of their relationship?
I mean, they just always came across to me as just a happy family, you know? They spent a lot of time together, you know, and like I said, when Sandy got sick, well, when she was first diagnosed with the lupus. And, you know, Jim was very involved in actively seeking out, you know, any possible cures or treatments or whatever. I mean, they were just very involved with each other's lives. You know, they were close. And I've never even heard Liz ever say anything about her childhood that was, you know, every story she's ever told has been a positive story about her parents' interactions in her lives, you know? I mean, just always telling stories about, you know, whether it's, you know, something silly that her dad used to do to her, a joke that, you know, like I said, whenever we were around them, what I remember about them most is just them laughing. I mean, that's kind of how I picture them.
Yeah, everyone I talk to always talks about Jim's sense of humor and his Jim jokes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I haven't been around Jim, you know, since I was a teenager. So at that point, you know, for me, I think it was just one of those eye-rolling sort of, you know. Yeah, that's funny.
Right. Okay, so now you ended up playing a role with the family during Sandy's trial, didn't you?
Right. You know, after Sandy had sent me that, you know, the request on Facebook to be listed as a member of her family, I was just really touched by that. And so I almost felt a sort of loyalty towards her, you know? Mm-hmm. Just that, I mean, she had been kind to me. She'd always been kind to me when a lot of people just really didn't bother speaking to me anymore. Mm-hmm. And so Liz had posted on Facebook, you know, she was coming into town. She was needing help with her kids while they were, you know, having the jury selection and then the trial. And she needed a babysitter. So I offered to do it. And I was living probably about an hour and a half outside of Houston. So it had to be under the conditions that I stay wherever they were staying. Uh-huh. And so they were staying with another friend. And I would just come into town and, you know, stay there during the duration. And yeah, so I was there pretty much throughout the whole thing.
So what was that experience like? I mean, was Sandy coming home there every day after trial and you guys talking about the trial and things?
Yeah, it was pretty intense. I mean, I don't think that it ever occurred to anyone there that it was even possible that she would have been convicted. And so that was mostly what the conversation revolved around, was reassuring her, because everyone, I mean, we couldn't even imagine that happening, really. Like, there didn't seem to be any way that anyone could look at the case and not walk away with at least reasonable doubt. And so it wasn't really like a scared, sad environment. I mean, there were sober moments, because it is scary. I mean, your fate is in the hands of people you don't know, you know? Mm-hmm. But it was really just more, you know, everyone kind of comforting each other and saying, don't worry. Like, there's no way. There's no way this can happen.
And then Liz obviously came home and told you that it did happen.
Yeah. Well, I remember the morning that they were going for the verdict, to hear the verdict. And everybody was getting ready. And, you know, I mean, there was a lot of anxiety in the air. And I remember Sandy was, they were getting ready to leave, and she was standing, you know, kind of in this entryway area. It had like a bench, and she was standing there by herself. She just put her shoes on and she kind of stood up, and I saw her sort of like put her hand like on her chest, and she just sat back down. And I remember somebody like running over to her and hugging her, and she kind of started crying for a second, and then she just said, I'm okay. She was sort of always trying to comfort everyone else and make sure that everyone else was okay. Mm-hmm. And then when they got home that afternoon, you know, Liz's daughter was, she'd been coloring a picture in the kitchen for her grandmother. And so when they walked in, she didn't notice at first that Sandy wasn't with them. And so she ran over there, you know, saying, "Nana, Nana, look what I colored for you." And then she stopped, "Where's Nana?"
Oh, God.
And I just remember Liz's husband saying, you know, we're gonna go upstairs and have a conversation. You know, it's a very sad conversation, and I'm going to need you to be a big girl, you know? And they all went upstairs together to talk to, you know, their daughter. And she came back downstairs a little while later, and she started coloring a picture for the police so that they would know that her Nana didn't do anything wrong and that they had made a mistake.
I have one more question for you. Is Sandy Melgar a killer?
No, there's no way. I mean, I'm a pretty skeptical person in general. And, you know, like, I'm not emotionally tied to this in such a way that I need her to be innocent or guilty. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it wouldn't really impact my life other than, you know. But just knowing her and having been around them at all, I mean, I can't imagine anybody would say that that was even a possibility with her, with them. I mean, between her and Jim, I mean, there's just nothing to suggest it, nothing. And I've never known her to be anything other than a kind, calm, pretty happy person.
Stephanie is not an exception to the rule. She is the rule. No one, not us, not the prosecution, and not the police, were ever able to find anyone that would say anything other than the fact that Jim and Sandy were both kind, loving, and patient people. They had a great relationship, and they honored each other. Not a single character witness has ever come forward and said that they can even fathom Sandy killing anyone, much less her husband. To the people who are close to the Melgars, the idea of Sandy being Jim's killer is absolutely preposterous. But at this point, the case for Sandy's innocence is not much different than the case for her guilt. Circumstantial and speculative. The only way that we're ever going to figure this case out is to take a deep dive into the evidence. And hopefully, if all things go well in Houston, we're going to begin that process next week on Truth and Justice. Truth and Justice is a production of NBI Studios. Michael Bussing is your executive producer, and Shane Yoder is our sound engineer. All music for the show was created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. And Shane Yoder of PutThemInASong.com also created our Season 6 logo. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $1 a month. And we also have reward levels on the Patreon page that include access to the behind-the-scenes videos of the taping of our Friday follow-up episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. But the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can follow along on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on the case. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.